Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today we're speaking with Francis Spufford about his book from 2010, Red Plenty, about the idea that progress and abundance were going to come out of the planned Soviet economy. And what Spufford did was tell different historically based stories about individuals who worked within this economy.
My interest was in how an economic idea affects lives.
We're very happy to be speaking with Francis Spufford about his book. Thanks so much for joining us. Francis Spufford, thank you so much for speaking with us and about your book, Red Plenty, your recent book. And first, talk about a little bit about the combination that you use between historical facts and the very extensive footnotes along with the fictional characters.
I kind of felt it needed to have both elements in it because I didn't want just the one thing or just the other thing. My interest was in how an economic idea affects lives rather than just kind of trying to come to some kind of abstract assessment of it. So I needed some tangible humans in there so that you could see what it did. But conversely, I didn't just want to tell the kind of the usual novelistic story about private lives. I wanted to be writing about ideas and about the way that people are connected together in economies, as well as connected together in, you know, friendships, marriages, workplaces, the usual things that novels are about.
Please tell us about the economic idea that's really the basis of this story in your book.
It's about a piece of mathematics, really, which took an unusually starring role in the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s, because on it they ended up hanging their hopes that they would outdo capitalism at its own game. One of the things I wanted to remind people of is that once upon a time, communism, the materialistic part of communism, was supposed to be taken literally. It was supposed to vindicate itself by producing abundance. It wasn't supposed to be a system of austere totalitarian dedication. It was supposed to outdo capitalism at producing, you know, a very concrete, very literal version of the good life. And that there was a short period, kind of the Sputnik moment, but lasting a bit longer, in which people in the Soviet Union thought that they were actually succeeding at that, and in which people in the outside world were scared of the Soviet Union as an economic power in very much the same way that people are now anxious about China and India. One of my starting points was a Paul Krugman article pointing out that some of the editorials written about Chinese growth rates now could be used word for word in the 1950s for writing about Soviet growth rates. But the piece of math is something that starred as the last and cleverest version of the idea that the planned economy was more rational than the market and therefore had systemic advantages, that whereas capitalism was hopelessly blind and composed of a thousand different impulses pulling in different directions, the planned economy could be goal directed, and the piece of mathematics in question, here's the first of a million ironies, has been taken up and used by corporations all over the planet. It's what's now called linear programming or operational research, and it was invented by two different people who eventually shared, or by some count three different people, who eventually shared the Nobel Prize for it. But one of them, at the Soviet end of this story, was a very brilliant mathematician called Leonid Vitalievich Kantorovich, who invented it first and completely independently in 1938 in Leningrad, and it was a way of solving otherwise impossible systems of linear equations by using what he called shadow prices or objective multipliers. Essentially, it's a way of valuing any particular piece of production you do in terms of the production you forego by doing that and not something else. It's a way of bringing opportunity costs into a calculation quantitatively. And he spent the rest of his life trying to persuade the Soviet hierarchy that they should use his discovery. And it did get taken up officially in the later 50s and the 60s, and it looked for a while as if it was going to be made the centerpiece of Soviet economics, which deeply appeals to kind of my geeky interest in the sudden power of ideas, but also seemed to me to be a very interesting way into thinking about the planned economy at all. Not a subject, burningly at the top of anybody's list, really, early in the 21st century, since whatever our economic hopes and expectations are now, pretty much nobody would be dumb enough to suggest that we ought to be trying a model in which everything is controlled by the state. Nevertheless, it seemed to me to be a useful way to kind of to get myself and maybe get other people thinking again about capitalism, really, not just as a kind of thing coterminous with nature, not just as a kind of environment in which we all find ourselves, but as itself a chosen thing, a thing that comes in lots of varieties, a thing which you can ask critical questions about. So I was taking a kind of doomed critique of capitalism and using it to talk about how capitalism worked and how the planned economy worked.
Going from there, in the idea of critically analyzing capitalism to the Soviet setting, can you tell us about that?
Going from there, I had to sort of think myself, as well as an outsider can, into the Soviet setting, which is intellectually complicated to say the least. Given that what you've got here is essentially it's a sort of a contribution to what's called the socialist calculation debate, which had been running ever since kind of von Mises made his first critique of the possibilities of a state planned economy back in the 1920s, and it had gone this way, it had gone that way. The tricky thing about assessing this in that context is that the Soviet actors hardly knew about the rest of the debate. They were more or less cut off from a world in which economic ideas could be freely exchanged. One of the peculiar things about it is that they are very mathematically sophisticated, and they have incredibly limited access to what's normal in economics on the rest of the planet. They don't even have access to sort of the ordinary mathematical formalizations of economics. So simple things to do with kind of marginal efficiency are more or less alien to them. In a way, I think this makes them more impressive because they think their own way autonomously to some of the major problems and try to solve them. For example, they're not reading Hayek, so they don't have Hayek's name attached in their heads to the major problem with planning, which is the classical Hayek problem is the knowledge problem, that knowledge is not distributed in any possible economy, planned or market, in a way that would make it genuinely accessible to a planner at the center. It's often tacit knowledge, the sense of what the economic possibilities are of anyone producing or consuming, possessed locally. There are no obvious rational ways to pass that knowledge intact to the center where it could be genuinely acted on. they didn't think of that as the Hayek objection, but they had a kind of lively local sense based on the practical problems of central planning that it really was very difficult getting knowledge to the center. So the power of this late intellectual proposal for how to do central planning is that they find a kind of workaround for that.
So please tell us what Leonid Vitalievich Kantarovich, the Soviet economist who won the Nobel Prize, aimed to show in his theorems about how a planned economy could be more efficient than a market economy.
What Kantarovich demonstrates is that for any given plan, that is to say, a list of kind of desired outcomes, things you want to produce, for any given plan, there exists a set of prices you can calculate, which could be used in a decentralized fashion to create a set of incentives, which, if local managers acted on them, would miraculously produce the most optimal satisfaction of the plan at the center. So you use your early computers to generate the set of prices, which provide a perfect set of inducements for local decision making. And all that the locals have to do then is to maximize their profits, and you get a miraculous congruence between that local level and the results at the center, and the whole system gets a market-like advantage of decentralization and a planner-like advantage of being able to surge strongly towards some one particular desired outcome. This is a piece of math of genuine power, which is why it gets used inside lots of what you might call kind of provocatively the little planned economies inside major corporations, places where in fact price signals of the conventional kind and not really what decision making is based on. And my book, it doesn't sound a very promising subject for anything novelistic, does it? But my book is about the human consequences of that idea, and about why it turned out not to be possible to apply it in the USSR in the 50s and 60s of the 20th century. This is a fanciful project because, of course, you can't demonstrate solid reasons for a negative. And in some ways, I have to be honest and say that I'm using the fictional form to be not terribly rigorous about the weight to which I give various possible explanations about why it didn't happen. But in a way, I'm in a luxurious position here because I don't have to know, because there are so many reasons. It's such a kind of an overdetermined failure that simply getting into some of them and exploring them is quite illuminating.
And your book really highlights the difficulties in running a centrally planned economy with automated prices. Can you talk about those difficulties?
The first difficulty is that producing automated artificial prices requires that the planners that actually exist take their hands off the system. It means that the kind of the pragmatic elements of the Soviet system as it existed, in which planners were in a position to see something going wrong and give them a nudge back towards the desired outcome, would be gone. So there would be no sort of voluntary human stabilizers in the system anymore. It would just go where it wanted to, it was perfectly clear to those who did the actual planning at the center, as opposed to visionary mathematicians, that this could lead to snarl-ups and gridlocks far worse than the existing systems. There were pragmatic reasons for not trying to improve it on those lines. There was also a different informational problem, which is not the classic Hayek one, but simply to do with working backwards from the consumption side to the production end, and try to work out how much of of anything the system actually desired to get to its chosen goal. It's all very well to say we can move you with 14% more efficiency to your desired outcome of products if there is utter vagueness about what a desired outcome of product actually is and how it would serve the general goal of economic advance. And at this point, the Soviet Union had built the heavy industry, which was supposed to work as the launch pad for a more general prosperity, and discovered that it is virtually impossible to specify in detail the economically advantageous selection of outputs that will move you into a more and more detailed, more and more variegated consumer plenty. So there was that. There's also a problem of lying. Given that the abstract incentives created by these mathematically generated prices would be in competition with every other incentive built into the system, the political incentives, the monetary incentives, the incentives of reputation and status. And one of the things I've tried to get into in a central section of the book is an exploration of how the Soviet economy actually worked and how little it resembled the idealized mathematical diagrams that were being optimized, given that local managers had, in kind of descending order of priorities, somewhere up at the top is simply keeping goods moving out of the factory gate, which means keeping in well with your suppliers, followed by a prioritization of where production goes to, which is entirely to do with a kind of non-cash, non-economic sense of the greatest political clout of your different customers, followed by the manager's own interest in their bonuses, which was deliberately highly geared to incentivize overproduction of the plan. So if you did 99% of your plan output, you get no bonus at all. But if you managed to do 102% of your plan output, you could be looking at a kind of several hundred percent increase in your base salary. This gave them, of course, an overwhelming incentive to get the plan target reduced enough to make 102% fulfillment easier. The real problem with any kind of system-wide optimization is that it puts all your eggs in one basket. It bets the ranch on one particular kind of scheme of economic betterment, when what you need a market for is not some highly efficient allocative algorithm, but to provide you with a way to let different plans contend without systemic consequences, a way of in fact choking back consequences rather than letting them run with glorious rationality all the way to the horizon.
One interesting character who kind of arises organically out of this economy is this guy, the pusher. He kind of fills the gaps when there's not nearly enough supply of things on the shelves or whatever. He kind of can work his magic to talk to one person and use his connections. Can you tell us how you came to write about a character like this?
Yes, I find. Yeah, I thought the pusher was a fascinating figure. I don't mean the particular guy I invented, who is my idea of what a good operator would be in that setting. But I mean the actual figure of the toll catch or pusher. He is. As you say, he is a natural, organic creation of that economy, and he's like a kind of, as in so many ways, the Soviet economy is a kind of funhouse mirror image of a market economy. In this case, he is the through the looking glass equivalent of a salesman, except that in the Soviet Union, which is a permanent seller's market, where anything that they can get out the door is is snatched by cash-rich, choice-poor people. Except in the Soviet Union, you don't need salesmen. Salesmen are... They're the people who are responsible for selling things, in quote marks, in the Soviet Union, only have to get them to the shelves, and the public will take care of the rest. The tricky bit, the sharp end of the economy, is in the need to buy things. So rather than a salesman, what you get generated spontaneously is the figure of the professional buyer, the person who, like a salesman in a market economy, specializes in finding non-economic inducements to do this economic act. What salesmen know your children's birthdays. Salesmen are nice and warm and make it a pleasure to buy their office supplies, you know, because they want you to go with them. In the Soviet case, a buyer wants you to take the stuff you produce and to give it to his clients. So he will provide you with every non-economic inducement he can to do it. And these people lived quite high on the hog, really, in Soviet terms. They lived in hotels on enormous retainers, and they specialized in having vast mental Rolodexes or address books that let them niche together the most complicated deals, but not deals in terms of money. This, after all, is an economy in which money is not that important. Money is a kind of symbolic marker here that a deal has been done, but nobody's ever constrained by the lack of money. They are only constrained by the lack of stuff or by the difficulty of finding a relationship to obtain the stuff. So pushers are specialists in relationships. They're specialists in creating a personal reason why the vast, seemingly impersonal machine of Soviet industry should do thing A, which is what you want as the pusher's client, rather than thing B, which will benefit some other person. And I thought, you know, we know this guy. Even though he breaks every rational rule of our own expectations, he is somebody doing something deeply intelligible given the setting. And nobody liked them in rather the same way that people don't really like salesmen. They always suspect that the friendliness has some other motive, which it does. So every now and again, these people were kind of rounded up or given a hard time, and I've given my pusher the day from hell in some respects. He has a very nasty brush with some gangsters. He needs to buy some copper pipe from, followed by an even worse brush with the with a local policeman who is not the policeman he's paid off. But I let him speak the absolute truth in the story when I say that, like, I have him say, I'm a servant of the plan. He is. Without the kind of lubrication provided by the pushers, the plan would not have functioned half as well as it did. Given the absence of price signals to lead goods around in an impersonal way, there had to be a personal replacement for the impersonal role of money. And this is one of the things that surprised me first and then fascinated me most about the whole project, that that you expect on the face of it that a planned economy will be this very impersonal contrivance, that it will be governed by ideological ambitions, it will be bureaucratic and therefore rule bound, that it will be to do, in accordance with its knowledge problems, it will be to do with manipulating things at some very high level of abstraction in enormous bundled together categories, as in the Ministry of Non-Ferrous Metals, for example. And none of these things are true. I mean, there was a Ministry of Non-Ferrous Metals, but the actual basis for transactions was more personal than in a market economy. The thing that we perhaps take for granted is how efficiently money works to to replace relationships in a huge number of everyday transactions. The money itself and the quantitative signal built into the price encodes lots of the personal stuff. And if you've got the $57 and somebody is willing to sell for $56.50, then that's pretty much all the relationship you need in a market economy. If everybody in the landscape has got $57 and the notional price is $56.50, but nobody cares, but there's only one of whatever the thing is, then the way in which you set about finding the thing is going to be deeply personal. It will involve you pulling on every thread of personal obligation you can reach, and the result is an economy which is grossly personal in some ways, but not in a warm, cuddly way. We're not talking about the overcoming the alienating effects of capitalism here. We're talking about something whose fuel is back scratching, intimidation, favor trading, sycophancy, people having to run enormously complicated personal account books in which they kept track of who they'd done favors to and who owed them a favor, and you know, without being able to use money as a kind of brokering medium in between commodities, tried to guess how much being given a holiday on the Black Sea is worth in terms of, you know, violin lessons. I mean, given no denominator there, how many violin lessons does it take to pay for a holiday on the Black Sea, or for an appointment with an ophthalmologist, or getting in to see any medical specialist? Guesswork and deeply, deeply personal relationships at every turn. It was in some respects the opposite of its reputation.
The book and this story about the pusher made for very interesting reading, in you showing how an economic idea can affect people's lives. And in this case, in the Soviet Union, there was very little supply of goods, and sometimes there was this pusher type of figure to help fill in the gaps. Thanks so much for speaking with us today, Francis Bufford.
You're very, very welcome.
This is the Logic Consortium, and that was our conversation with Francis Bufford about his 2010 book, Red Plenty.